Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Monday, January 29th, 2024, and the time is 1:02 p.m. We are meeting in the Max Gruenberg Committee Room 120 in the Capitol Building here in Juneau. Ask that you please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Susan with the Juneau LAO and Sophia with House Records. I don't believe that's Susan. I know. I thank you for being here, though. The following members present is Representative Johnson, Representative Gray, Representative Groh, Vice Chair Allard. Representative Sumner is joining us via Teams, and myself, Chair Vance. We have a quorum to conduct business. On today's agenda, we have three items on the calendar, with the first hearings on House Bill 170, Misuse of Public Officers' Official Position by Representative Kronk, House Bill 88, Warehouse Work Quotas by Representative Rauscher, and House Bill 63, Repeal Workers' Comp Appeals Commission, also by Representative Rauscher. So the first item on our agenda is House Bill 170 by Representative Kronk. I'd like to welcome you to the table. If you could please join us by stating your names for the record and walking us through your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Mike Kronk, District 36, and to my right is my staff, Dave Stancliffe. I'm just going to go over the sponsor statement for HB 170. It's an act relating to the misuse of an official position. So there's an old saying, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Like our existing ethics law, House Bill 170 is all about prevention. It's intended to prevent any public official who might be tempted to personally use their position or influence to punish or put pressure on a person or business not to do so. This addition to the existing ethics statutes expressly prohibits such punitive action by a public official and makes it punishable under existing Ethic Act provisions. Providing this protection will increase public confidence, knowing it is unlawful for public officials to use their authority for personal reasons.
I'd like to take this moment to mention that Representative Carpenter has joined us at 104. Please continue.
So I'm going to turn it over to my staff. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate being here in front of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Dave Stancliffe, staff to Representative Kronk. We've had some instances of complaints from constituents, of which all of our offices receive. And in some of the investigation and evidence in those complaints suggests that when a person who has the ability to regulate or put into effect policy goes beyond what the public purpose for doing that is, persons and businesses can be severely damaged. And so Representative Kronk asked that I look at what other states have done, what the federal government has done with regard to protecting people from their government. And this is the first legislation that I know of in the United States that actually tries to put into place some restraints legally that prevent an inspector or a policy person who carries out a policy from taking punitive action against a person for reasons other than appropriate state business. And I stop short of saying it's landmark, but it's a step in the right direction. Just as with our ethics laws, without trying to get into who's violating them or what the specifics are, which often can involve individuals, this legislation is aimed at being preventative in that a commissioner can say to the people underneath them, this isn't my policy, it's in statute. When you take action against a person in the name of our department, you don't have the ability legally to go beyond what the public purpose is, no matter what their political affiliation is, no matter how they talk, which flag they have in their front yard, which bumper stickers they have on their truck or car. You can't bring any of those personal reasons into play, not because I say so, but because the legislature has said in statute that it's unethical to do so. So the language that you have before you is merely an extension of the ethics law. The question of what will happen if it's violated ranges from up to a $5,000 fine for a person that does violate it, up to a misdemeanor if there are several aspects of the violation, which legal would talk to you at some point in the future about.
Does this conclude your presentation?
Pardon?
Any further presentation?
That's the background on the legislation and kind of an overview of where it stands at this point. Where the committee goes is obviously up to you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation, Representative Kronk and Mr. Stancliffe. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I like the underlining sentiment of the bill, but I had a couple of questions about some of the language. So justifiable public purpose, I'm just curious because it says that except in the case of a justifiable public purpose, and I'm wondering if we already have that defined in statute or if you can just elaborate a little bit about what exactly justifiable public purpose is.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, Dave Stancliffe from staff to Representative Kronk. That is the best language that our drafters could come up with that was compatible with existing ethics law. And it means basically, he kind of defines it, means a purpose related to the best interests of the state, not including the following. So I would interpret that as being what we would expect normally and is in harmony with the ethics statute. However, as you pointed out, it is a new term.
Follow up. And I think this is just for me to have like a more concrete understanding. Can you give an example of a case where this law would be used?
Representative Kronk, you know of one maybe?
Through the chair, I do know of one specific a department pretty much sent a white paper to a constituent that had a bunch of very misinformed facts. And in this case, it cost this constituent from purchasing a very large piece of equipment for his business because without the proper, let's say, sale that he needed, he could no longer go finance this piece of equipment from his business. And so this became very concerning to us because an official used their position and really put some very misleading information there that, of course, we rebutted. But it was too late because this person could not go get the loan for this piece of equipment. So it did set him back. And that's kind of the basis of this, because we really don't want to see that happen to anybody, especially. And it doesn't matter if it's a small town, city. Business is business, and these people are trying to make a living, create jobs for people. And in this case, it literally stopped a $500,000 purchase, which would have created numerous jobs for people. So I'm trying to be as delicate as I can in this situation, but. That's an example for us, real example.
Follow up. So my understanding from that example is that currently it's legal to send white papers that have misleading, misinformed information. And so this law would make it so that it was no longer okay to send misleading, misinformed information. The part that I guess I was curious about was, I kind of dwelled in on like, having a brother or a sister or some sort of like kinship relationship or using your office and your relationship to the public office to make things happen. I guess, so right now, just to get back to this example, it is legal what happened, but you want to make it illegal. You want to make it illegal to send misleading information as an official department memo.
Through the chair. I'm going to let Dave answer that.
Madam Chair, Dave Stancliffe for Representative Kronk's office. Representative Gray, in this case, it was the use of completely false and misleading information at the highest levels. and a prolonged effort that cost a person $500,000 and set the family business back years. And the evidence was, it was there. And so, without getting into any personal names or anything like that, this bill would allow, if an investigation ensues, to find a person who did such a thing in fault, and a fine or even higher, a misdemeanor, could occur. Like the ethics laws, when something like this goes into place, the word goes out very quickly. It goes out in policy through each administration, each department. Doesn't matter what a person's lifestyle is or what their choices are. When you can't use information that's false or misleading, and in this case, the person felt like it was because they were vocally, strenuously in opposition to a piece of legislation that particular division wanted, and a prior record of action that had been ongoing was suddenly changed completely for no reason. And then when it was questioned, a letter with completely false and misleading information went out to justify it. And so you can kind of, I don't think any of that would have happened had this language been in statute.
Thank you.
We have two other people in the queue. If you can.
Okay. I'll follow up immediately on that point in a few minutes.
We have Rep. Sumner on Teams who has a question.
Through the chair, so justifiable public purpose, if my decision process on a close decision involves, say, flipping a coin or consulting a magic eight ball, would that be then unethical, or would it require malign intent?
Through the chair, Dave Sancliffe, Representative Cronk's office, Representative Sumner, I think in mitigating these type of conflicts, evidence will have to be a little more substantial than flipping a coin or turning the magic eight ball over, because now you've put in statute that this is a serious offense. So there would have to be a culmination of gathering evidence to back any accusations, and that evidence then would have to be weighed by the administration handling the particular problem. So I don't want to try in any way reduce the meaning of justifiable public purpose, but I think it goes a little deeper than just the arbitrary judgment that sometimes is needed in looking at what the state interest on a particular issue might be. I mean, that's understandable. When you go beyond that and there's evidence to support it, this bill would kick in.
A follow-up, Madam Chair?
Follow-up, Rep. Sumner.
Through the chair. So I guess I ask that in that way, because would you potentially be guilty of a misdemeanor just simply through inconsistency of decision, or would there be required some proof of intent?
Through the chair, Representative Sumner, Dave Stancliffe with Representative Cronk's office. As in any adjudication, there would have to be evidence. And there would have to be evidence that if action wasn't taken, say omission versus commission, I think the weight would be pretty heavy to have to bring forth an actual conviction. No one's perfect and people are going to make mistakes, but you have to have intent involved here for this to kick in.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard and then Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we have legal on the line too?
Let's take a brief itties. Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And through the Chair, Representative Kronk, I have a couple of questions. Can you, and you might not, that's why I wanted to ask for legal. Your team keeps using the term misleading. Do you know the legal definition of misleading by any chance? Or how you're using that? I would say misleading to me is lying, but that's really not the legal definition.
Through the chair, again, we realize there probably will be some questions for legal, and I would hope that if this bill is heard again, that we would have legal on the line to specifically answer those questions for you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just going to say this on the record, too, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
Definition of public officer. That's probably something we need from legal as well. Is that correct, Representative Kronk? Okay, so then here would be my actual question to you. thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. So if I can give you a scenario, could you tell me, based on your bill, if this scenario might be able to fall into it or if this is something you guys would consider? Okay. Madam Chair, if I may.
Please continue.
So if there was a government official in a different body and that government official constantly or consistently recuses himself on a vote because it's a conflict of interest, they say, and this government official sits on a nonprofit body, and the body in which this government official sits on votes, pays, allows, distributes funds into this individual's nonprofit, where this individual elected official gets their income or salary. Do you think that this bill here could fit that in there? I'm leaving names out, but I can give a closer scenario so it makes a little more sense if you'd like.
Through the chair, Representative Allard, David Stancliffe with Representative Kronk. I think it very well could, because this is part of the Ethics Act that applies to administration, not the legislature per se. But if you receive false information that's intentionally given to you to benefit someone or someone you know, or to hurt someone you know, they know, definitely this comes into play. If they're defined as a public official and they have power as a public official and they misuse that power to do any of these things, this definitely would come into play.
Okay, I see amendment on the horizon. Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Representative Groh.
I do think it's really beneficial, Madam Chair, and thank you, Madam Chair, to get legal advice on this. I worked for years as a lawyer, not serving as a lawyer today, I want to promise that. But in my legal career in both civil and criminal practice officing, sometimes you have questions of intent. We've sort of danced around this or alluded this somewhat. Sometimes people announce what their intent was, either publicly or maybe in, secretly recorded tape recordings. Other times it's pretty hard to know what intent was. And so you look for other indicators. There's some discussion here in this proposed legislation of things that I would call essentially conflicts of interest, and talk about that. And then in the testimony from the sponsor and the staff, and thank you for bringing the bill forward, there's also some discussion when we talk about false and misleading information. There are a lot of reasons that could occur. That could occur from improper purpose. It could occur from lack of information. It could occur, frankly, from stupidity. But it's just harder to, and I think that's really helpful to get, like I said, and I would ask to make sure we have some good legal advice on this.
So, Representative Groh, my apologies for not having them right away, but we do have Noah Klein from Legislative Legal Services. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. The question I wanted to ask is, I'd like you to reconcile, and I don't know, you haven't been here before at this hearing online, but the proposed legislation itself talks about justifiable public purpose and defines it as a purpose related to the best interest of the state, and then excludes various things that are not involved in determining a justifiable public purpose. And then we've had discussion here at the table Mr. Klein, about false and misleading information, and the particular example that apparently gave rise to this bill, I think it's useful for you to could you address the question of intent here, the question of determination of evidence, and actually both of those issues here related to this involved in this particular bill. Thank you, sir.
Through the chair to Representative Groh. I'm sorry, as you recognized, first of all, this is Noah Klein, Legislative Legal Services. I have not been on the line for the conversation, so I'm not sure I understand the question in the context of the bill.
Can I elaborate?
Follow up?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. So the example that's been brought forward as the reason this bill has been introduced and pursued through the legislative process is that a constituent of Representative Cronk's believed that false and misleading information was used by a public official, apparently an official in the executive branch of the state of Alaska, in a way that hurt this particular citizen. And the citizen believed that the reason this false and misleading information was presented by the public official was because the citizen was strenuously opposed to some legislation that the department that in which the public official served was promoting or supporting. I guess I'd first ask if I'm accurately describing the factual scenario.
I need to take a brief at ease. Back on the record, Vice Chair Allard.
So I have a concern with other members of this body, Representative Cronk, putting words into your mouth or definitions and speaking to your motive. I believe that if you had said that, that's one thing, but we do have members on this committee right now that are saying that you're saying certain things, and I never heard that come out of your mouth, and I feel like it's impugning you in a way it shouldn't. So I don't know if you want to speak on that. I just don't think it's okay.
Representative Cronk, would you like to clarify so that legal can answer the question that was raised more accurately?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair. So the scenario would be a person was asking for something that he'd previously gotten through the state, and a person that works for the state figured out a way around and denied him that. Okay. And through that process, we realized that there is, I use the word misleading. There is a lot of false statements for the denial. And we feel justified in bringing this bill forward because that person felt that because he opposed some prior legislation, that this was per se punishment for him being very vocal against it. And again, this wasn't a small amount of money. This was a way of securing his future for his family. You know, by being denied what he'd gotten before, he lost an opportunity for a loan, which, you know, when you're talking $500,000, it's a lot of money. So I guess that would be the clarification of Representative Groh's possible question.
Accepted.
So, Representative Groh, do you have a direct question
Sure.
for legal services?
Yes. Mr. Klein, could you describe the role of intent in this proposed legislation and particularly also how that intent is determined in terms of because it does seem to be the justifiable public purpose seems to be wrapped up with questions of intent. Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Klein.
Through the chair to Representative Groh, this is Noah Klein again, Legislative Legal Services. The prohibition in this legislation doesn't speak to a specific mental state or intent of the public official. It's just a prohibition on doing something if it doesn't meet the standard of a justifiable public purpose as defined in the Act.
Follow up.
I'm going to let, thank you, Madam Chair. I'll let other members ask questions.
So I think the committee has taken a deep dive on some pretty extreme measures. I want to bring it back to how many of the people of my district may see this. Snow plowing. We have hear a lot of complaints that our state plows are being punitive against members by piling up large amounts of snow in their driveway. Now, we know that DOT is doing its very best to address the roads. So, you know, a member of the public may say, hey, I've started to see them being intentional about making a hardship for me to get out of my driveway. That seems out of the ordinary. And maybe they have justifiable actions that they can add up evidence, if you will. Is this the type of legislation that says someone from a department is really picking on a member of the public, and it's obvious to everyone else around them? Is this the type of thing that someone within their department head would be able to say, hey, we have an ethics act here that says you cannot be singling out a member of the public. You have to show that what you're doing, as states right here, justifies a public purpose. Is this the type of scenario that you would see that this could be exercised?
Madam Chair, Dave Stankle, through the chair, I have a list of complaints, some of the major ones and the most heartbreaking ones through 30 years of staff work that involved decisions that at the very least are questionable, much more serious than snow in a yard, problems in OCS that have train wrecked reputations, caused people to have to move. So yes, it would be great as an administrator, I suppose, to be able to say, you can't do this and here's the statute as to why. And if you'd allow me, with Representative Groh, similar questions had arisen when we asked to have the bill drafted. It was placed in an existing ethics part of the statutes that addresses intent. This is not new law. It's expanded existing law. The question for the policymakers, of course, you're all seated here, whether this is going to be preventative or used punitively. And I would say, just as with the ethics provisions, some various serious things that were happening before those ethics provisions were enacted are no longer happening because they were enacted. So I expect the same would happen here. Yes, if someone said, we're getting reports that you, for some reason, are blocking driveways because you've got a little issue going, it's not a matter of me disciplining you and keeping the discipline out of sight of the public. It's about statute. And so I'm just letting you know, a little shot across the bow, that even though it's not serious to you, it can be serious to you. So that's how I see it. But it would be a full range of other stories. And I will pass along to you that a person within DOT, not within your region, when this issue came up, they're retired now. I said, does that happen very often? Or, you know, internally, are they saying, hey, we'll teach that guy or that person? Absolutely. They said, unbelievably so. It's human nature, when you're in contention, to win the battle. And a citizen is no match, singularly, against the powers of government. And people can say, well, there's civil remedies. No, not really. Who's got the money and the time to go up against the government? And so hopefully legislative offices will receive fewer of these contested situations, and we'll have better government, and it'll be preemptive and not punitive, which Representative Groh is necessarily concerned about.
Thank you for that clarification, Mr. Stancliffe. I am going to entertain one last question. It's simply because Rep. Sumner is joining us with Teams, and it's hard for me to see the little tiny yellow hand on the screen. So we will take this one last question. Representative Sumner.
Madam Chair, and through the chair to Noah Klein, it did sound like from his comments about the bill not contemplating intent, that we may be creating a strict liability crime here. And I suppose I would ask Noah Klein if that's his understanding, and then ask the bill sponsor if that is his intent, or possibly we should amend to include that intent is required for the criminal charge.
Through the chair to Representative Sumner, this bill is making an addition to the Ethics Act. The vast majority of the penalties related to the Executive Branch Ethics Act are civil penalties or penalties relating to employment. And ultimately, this additional paragraph would be interpreted by the Attorney General and the Personnel Board, as the case may be. And so, although there's no express intent or mental state required here, this would have to be applied by the executive branch in determining when something would in fact not have a justifiable public purpose. So I don't know that I would characterize this as a strict liability offense. There would be interpretation of whether or not something was done without a justifiable public purpose, whether or not the Attorney General or the Personnel Board would be considering intent. I think that might be a question for them at some point in the future.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and perhaps we could follow up with the Department of Law on this. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for your patience on me recognizing you, Representative Sumner. And I know that committee members do have more questions, and I understand you have more questions. We also have more questions from legal and the sponsor, but in keeping with time, we are now going to set this bill aside. We will bring it up again and have more legal insight, because I think this is very pertinent to the people. So thank you, Representative Kronk, for your presentation.
Can we have it at ease?
At ease. Back on the record, for our second agenda item, we will bring up House Bill 88, Workhouse Work Quotas, by Representative Rauscher. I would like to welcome Representative to the table with your staff, if you would please join us. Begin by please putting your names on the record, and you can begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Representative George Rauscher, District 29, and I want to thank the committee for hearing this bill. House Bill 88, Warehouse Workers Protection Act, is designed to provide transparency for warehouse and logistic workers when they agree to pay scale based on a quota or production goal. HB 88 is also designed to provide protections for workers against counterproductive methods employers miss the mark on to speed up production. Alaska is one of the most bountiful states in the country, and with its salmon runs, its wild game, and its natural resources. The abundance of the state is a blessing, but there's still a need for supplies and goods to be imported, stored, and or delivered. The workers who manage the logistics of these imports are using our unsung heroes of Alaska food security and supply chain. With over 90% of food coming in from outside of Alaska, these workers are the lifeline to keep the state operational. Warehouse and logistic workers face many challenges in the workplace. HB 88 will allow workers to force, to focus on delivering goods and maintaining a healthy supply chain while also ensuring they are able to work in a safe environment where employers don't encourage speed, where safety is going to be at risk. I'm going to turn over the chance to speak for my state chief of staff, Ryan McKee. He'll be going through the sectional.
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. Section 1 amends AS 2310 by adding new sections. Article 9, work quotas at warehouse distribution centers. Section 2310-700 specifies what types of employers the newly added sections AS 2310-700 through 2310-725 apply to. Specifically, 200 or more employees at a single warehouse distribution center, or 1,000 or more employees at one or more warehouse distribution centers in the state. Section 2310-705 specifies when an employer that is subject to AS 2310-700 through 2310-725 needs to provide a written description of each quota that applies to the employee. It further describes what needs to be included in that written quota description. Section 2310-710 states what specifically an employer is not allowed to require in order for employees to meet quota expectations. Section 2310-715 states that a current or former employee may request orally or in writing a request for a quota description and specifies what needs to be included in the request as well as a timeline for when an employee will receive the requested description. 2310-720 states that an employee may seek an injunction in the Superior Court to enjoin an employer violating AS 2310-700 through 2310-715. And then Section 2310-725 provides definitions for terms listed in the above language. And then Section 2 sets an effective date for January 1st, 2025. And then we do have invited testimony from Patrick Fitzgerald.
Thank you for that presentation. I believe that we have Mr. Fitzgerald on Teams. If you would state your name and affiliation for the record and begin your presentation, you have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Patrick Fitzgerald. I'm the political coordinator for Teamsters Local 959. I'm invited testimony for House Bill 88, the Warehouse Worker Protection Act. I want to thank the bill's sponsor, Representative George Rauscher, his staff, Ryan McKee, for introducing the legislation and carrying the bill. I'd also like to thank Chair Vance and Vice Chair Allard and the House Judiciary Committee for hearing this legislation. House Bill 88 will add to statute protections for warehouse and logistic workers to curb predatory practices that come with a quota-based warehouse job. This legislation will allow employees whose workload is based on quota-based output to have access to their work speed data and to advocate for themselves when that quota is changed. Having a mechanism for employees to request their work speed data allows the work to be done more efficiently, have safer working conditions, and a more consistent production for the company. Employees having access to this data will bring solutions to the work environment with problems concerning retention and turnover, having transparency and better understanding of operations. House Bill 88 provides protections that have been proven to reduce workplace accidents and quota-based jobs, such as allowing time for restroom breaks and reasonable work speed conditions, giving not to exhaust employees. This legislation will protect workers who maintain and operate warehouses that store over 90% of the food that comes into Alaska, conducts logistics for all construction materials that come into the state to build our future, and work to ensure the rural parts of the state are able to stay connected to a strong, consistent supply chain of food, medicine, and other goods. Please protect the Alaska warehouse workers and pass HB 88, and I will be available for questions should they arise from the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Do we have any questions from committee members? Representative Gray, do you have any questions?
I do. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, from version A to version B, I saw that there was a change from it was 100 or more workers, and it's now 200 or more workers. Can you explain the reason for changing from 100 to 200?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative Rauscher. Through the chair, Representative Gray. We wanted to increase that because we wanted to focus on the larger warehouse groups. We also didn't want to include any small businesses or make sure that there was unintended consequences for that, so we raised it up to 200.
Follow up.
Is there, I guess my concern was like if you had a company with 199 warehouse workers, they wouldn't get the protection of this bill. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, this bill would not apply to them, correct?
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, so I understand this. If a company has more than 200 employees and a company has all, it says to us, by the way, it's Christmas and we're going to have a higher quota and you're going to have to produce that higher quota midstream. So I'll give you an example, if you don't mind, Madam Chair. I know someone that worked at a bank. She was working there for quite some time. And as a part-time employee at the bank, she had a certain quota, right? She had to open so many savings accounts, so many checkings accounts. This was part of her job. And they changed it. And they said, you need to now meet this quota. So she could either, one, say, okay, I'll do it because things have increased, or she moved on, and she moved on. So what you're telling us is now we're going to regulate a business, telling them if your quota goes up, you have to go through all of this, which then makes all their fees go up and everything else. So the individual who perhaps doesn't want it to go up can just sue or go into court and just say, I don't want to go by your rules. Is that what this bill is saying?
Through the chair, Representative Allard, this is Representative George Rauscher. I think you've phrased it in a light that's probably not exactly the purpose of this bill. I just want to give you a little background on why I took this bill on. When I was a kid, I was 18 years old. I worked in a warehouse. It was a very, very, very large warehouse. And when I was hired, there was an expectation. It was a shingle. They made shingles. They made everything from rubber shingles to what's the stuff that you can't breathe? Asbestos shingles, the kind you see on buildings. They want to tear away, and you have to pretty much coat the whole house in plastic now to do that because of the certain ramifications for your lungs if you were to work around that kind of stuff. But anyway, and it was assembly line work. It was pallet stacking work. It was loading trucks. It was all kinds of things. But when you were told your expectations and you were wanting to follow them, and it was sometimes 103, 105 degrees, doesn't matter what the temperature was, but it was very hot. Some days it was very cold in the winter, but your expectations were given to you. And that is what everybody was agreeing to. And then all of a sudden they would just switch. And now you're working to a point where you're pulling muscles. You're getting tired. You're getting sleepy because you're working too hard. You're working too fast. And your hours are now longer, that kind of stuff. And it happens to you. It's not because you don't agree to it. It's because they've changed what they have to do now to get the product out there. Either it's too small of a contract or the contract, they couldn't get enough money for it or whatever. Well, I think they tax you beyond their limit. And so now to answer your question, yeah, I guess you can move on if there's another kind of job like that in your area. And I don't know where your area, where you live, but should you really have to quit your job just because they're going to work you to death? And I've seen people drop right next to me. So in my opinion, you should not have to drop just to earn a salary because you're now beyond the expectation of what they told you when they hired you.
May I follow up? Thank you. So I come from the world of military, safety first. Mm-hmm. So I understand big corporations, businesses that have 200 plus people probably fall under OSHA. So I don't know if I would agree that these companies, and I know which one we're referring to, would say they would work you to death. But then my other question is, why would we have to bring in the unions? Why are we discussing this with a union person here testifying unless we're trying to work to get this completely unionized? Because that's kind of what I'm feeling here.
You through the chair, Representative Rauscher, to Representative Allard's question. First off, I didn't bring in the unions for this, okay? I believe this bill was being shopped around, and it fit my history. It fit what I was going through when I was broke, when I needed a job. And it harked back to that, and I don't really care whether the union is on the television screen or not. It doesn't really bother me whether I'm working with a union person or whether I'm not working with a union person. I don't feel that this is to unionize this. I'm a legislator. I'm trying to do something which I think is to the benefit of the workers that are in the state, which could happen to them. And I never said that it is happening to them. I want that plain and clear. But I just feel that somebody shops a bill around, and I don't know who it is, but it doesn't matter. It fits me. And now if they decide that a union member would like to speak in favor of this, I'm not going to get all jacked out of shape about it.
May I? Thank you, Representative Rauscher. I appreciate your...
Thank you.
I do have a question, but Mr. Fitzgerald, would you care to address the concerns by Vice Chair Allard?
Yes, thank you. And kind of just going back to the first example about the increase in workplace quotas from Vice Chair Allard. First, this is Patrick Fitzgerald through the chair. In the warehouses that are defined in this legislation, typically what you see when there's a ramp up, such as holiday production, more parcels, more equipment coming into the warehouse, you'll see an increase in part-time employees or seasonal employees for the holiday season. So the workplace quotas would kind of get spread out with more people rather than drastic increases being made to the individual. Now, this is, of course, business practices. And what the main part of this bill is not the employer is already keeping this data. Workspeed data in a quota-based industry is already being kept, and it's being used to track the efficiency of the employees. The main part of this bill just allows for those employees to access that data, both represented and underrepresented by a collective bargaining unit. So I hope that might help some of your concerns for your first question. And then the second one is this will apply to all employees, both represented and non-represented in the state of Alaska. So we don't look at it as a union bill, as a non-union bill, we look at it as a pro-Alaskan bill.
Thank you, Mr. Fitzgerald. Representative Rauscher, on the technical components of the bill on page 2, the right to request the quota description, it talks about any changes that there's a 21-day calendar that's coming into effect in section 23107115. Can you describe what this 21-day calendar impact is? It's saying that employee may request that. Is this kind of addressing Rep. Allard's question about being forced to suddenly comply to changes? What are the implications of this 21-day calendar for an employee? Does this help with this communication?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, I will probably have to get back with you on that answer, and I will provide it for all the committee members on why that actually had to be in there, because legal had set it up there through some request that was either heard in the last committees or that was heard ahead of time, and I will get back to you with that answer. I apologize that I, but I would like to make another statement if you would allow. I think I'm probably noted for not voting with the unions every time anything comes up in the state, so to vote on in the, as a House member. So I don't think I'd be pushing anything that I think would be a union plan or something. And I just want to say that this just, I believe that the legislation here just protects workers, and I don't see it organizing anything at all, but that's my opinion.
Thank you, Representative Rauscher. Representative Johnson.
It'll be very interesting. So,
I think what I heard is that it is still the employer's ability to change the quota and to do that. But what this bill does is it allows the employee to know of the change. So it's transparent, and the 21 days falls into that. There's a calendar published. If it changes, the employer has rights. So I'm not sure this is not just an employer full disclosure to employees act. I mean, I need to dwell into it when we get into it a little more. But what I've heard so far is they have a right to know what they're supposed to be doing. So maybe I'm wrong on that. And one other thing, so I might have to ask another question. And this is physical notes. The first physical note we have is incomplete. It says prepared by committee. What committee? So I'd like to know who I need to call, if I need to call somebody. So I'd like to know, I'd like for it to be a complete physical note with contacts and who prepared it and what department and OMB stuff, so that I can reference that if I need to have comments made. So we're kind of paying attention to physical notes these days. Thank you, Madam Chair, and that's all I've got.
Thank you. And Representative Rauscher, if your office could follow up on those questions, we look forward to further discussion on this bill. Seeing no further questions from committee members at this time, we will set House Bill 88 aside, and we will take a brief at ease to transition to the next bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Back on the record, for our last agenda item today, we will hear House Bill 63, Repeal Workers' Comp Appeals Commission, by Representative Rauscher. If you would state your names again for the record and begin walking us through your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name, for the record, is Representative George Rauscher, House District 29, and I'd like to thank you and your committee for hearing this bill. House Bill 63 would save $482,400 per year, remove an unnecessary bureaucracy, and make Alaska Workers' Compensation Program more sustainable by repealing the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. Passing House Bill 63 will return jurisdiction over appeals of Workers' Compensation Board decisions to the Superior Court. Currently, the Appeals Commission handles these cases, and their decisions can be appealed to the Supreme Court. For decades, the Superior Court has handled these cases. Operating the Appeals Commission costs $482,400 annually, and it currently has 2 full-time employees. While the court system has testified that they can handle these cases with their current budget and staffing levels, the Appeals Commission's workload has decreased considerably since it was created in 2005. In 2007, they had 49 new cases filed and published 42 decisions, but by 2022, they only had 14 new cases and published only 5 decisions. 2015, House Labor and Workforce Finance Subcommittee found the Appeals Commission to be an ineffective division, and that their closure rate and average time for closure is not demonstrably better than the process was before the establishment of the commission. House Bill 63 would save that same amount and remove an unnecessary... Okay, I currently have 2 pages here which have some of the same data. I'm going to turn this over to my Chief of Staff, Ryan McKee, and he's going to go through a sectional for you. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher. Section 1 establishes that the Workforce Compensation Board shall maintain records of the repealed Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission. It also establishes that commission decisions remain as legal precedent unless overturned or modified by the courts. Section 2, 3, and 4 remove a reference to the commission. Section 5 creates a new AS 2330-126 governing appeals of workers' compensation board decisions. Subsection A establishes that the board decisions and orders become effective when filed, that these decisions and orders can be modified or reconsidered, and that a party may appeal a decision or order to the Superior Court. Subsection B establishes that the board decisions and orders are automatically staying pending judicial review and establishes the criteria for when a court may issue a stay. Subsection C establishes that factual findings made by the board shall be conclusive if supported by substantial evidence as that of AS 4462-570 governing administrative appeals shall apply to the appeals of board decisions. Subsection D allows the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation to intervene in appeals and to file appeals if a party is not represented by an attorney and the case presents an unsettled question of law. Section 6 is a conforming amendment that, to reflect the changes made by Section 5. Section 7 removes a reference to the commission. Section 8 repeals the court rules related to the commission. Section 9 repeals the statute related to the commission. Section 10 contains indirect court rule amendments to reflect the changes made by Section 5. And Section 11 establishes which procedures apply to appeals pending before the commission between June 1st and December 1st, 2023. And let me note that we are going to be hopefully doing a conceptual amendment to adjust these times, as obviously it's now 2024. Subsection A establishes that the commission shall continue to handle cases through December 1st, 2024, and that the commission shall continue all cases pending on December 2024. Again, we'll be correcting these dates. Subsection C establishes that the old statutes apply for appeals of final decision made by the commission and issued by December 1st. Section 12 establishes transitional provisions. Subsection A establishes that starting June 1st, 2024, all new appeals of board decisions shall be filled by the Superior Court under Section 5. Subsection B establishes that appeals of commission rulings issued by December 1st, 2024 shall be filed with the Supreme Court. Subsection C ends the commission's ability to order reconsideration of cases on December 2nd, 2024. All outstanding requests for reconsideration pending on that date would be automatically rejected, and any party whose request was denied may appeal their case to the Supreme Court. Subsection D requires the commission to transfer the files for all pending cases to the Superior Court on December 2nd, 2024, and to provide the parties 30 days notice of transfer of jurisdiction. If the court finds that the records do not meet the requirements of the rules of appellate procedure, it may order the commission to make necessary changes and resubmit them. Section 13 ends the terms of all commission members, again, on December 31st, 2024. Section 14 makes this act only take effect if the court rule changes in Section 8 and 10 are adopted. And then finally, Section 15 provides a June 1st, 2024 effective date. And that ends the sectional, and then we have a presentation here. So House Bill 63 repeals the Alaska Workers' Compensation Appeals Commission, returns the jurisdiction over to the Superior Court where it was previously held. It saves about $482,400 per year and then helps fill the workers' compensation budget deficit and makes Alaska workers' compensation system more solvent. So to begin with, here is basically how it goes. If a worker files a claim, it heads to the Workers' Compensation Board. If that party decides to appeal, currently it goes to the Workers' Compensation Commission. Our bill would send it back over to the Superior Court where it was previously decided prior to 2005. And then if they still would like to appeal, it would go to the Alaska Supreme Court. Currently, the commission has two full-time employees and then pays for commissioners' travel and per diem. And then previously, like we said, the court system has testified that they can absorb these cases And it is, I'd like to note that they have said that they can handle these cases, and their estimate was for 30, up to 30 cases. Currently, they have decided four cases last year. So this, again, we're pretty far down from where they have adjusted their fiscal note. So they can take up to 30, but right now the cases being submitted are far less than that. And then here you can see, in 2007, they had their highest workload from 49 cases and 42 published decisions. However, here in 2023, four cases were filed and five decisions were issued. So you can see there's quite a substantial and what I'd like to point out is a very consistent drop in cases. This isn't just a one-time thing. This has been since 2007. They've been dropping. And then again, the work. This is from the Department of Labor and Workforce Development, saying that again, the reason for bringing the commission to life was that they wanted to get the cases solved considerably faster. But even in 2013, when they had 30 cases and a closure rate of 67%, there wasn't that much of a big difference between when it was decided at the Superior Court and when it was decided through the commission. And I know in letters that have been submitted, that was one of the arguments, was that the compensation board decided cases quicker, but that's been proven to not be true. They're about the same. Again, the Superior Court in the beginning took 8 to 18 months to decide these compensation appeals. And when the Appeals Commission was created, it was estimated that they could decide cases in 6 months. But in 2018, it averaged 12 months to decide cases. And even as the workload decreased in 2021, it still averaged about 9.3 months to decide cases, even though the workload had dropped dramatically. And then also relating to time, more commission decisions are appealed to the Supreme Court, and that obviously adds a lot more time to go ahead and go to the Supreme Court. So again, bottom line is this is not creating a quicker decision for these, especially when a lot of them are instead appealed to the Supreme Court. And then on that note, when the Superior Court handled the appeals, about 25% of their decisions were appealed to the Supreme Court. Since then, when it was started in 2005, 36% of its decisions, now going through the commission board, appealed to the Supreme Court. And then in 2011, it went all the way up to half. So half of these are going to the Supreme Court, again, adding a lot of time to these decisions, which, again, the board that was created to be a quicker way for these cases to be solved. And we're seeing that that's not happening. Then on the overall cost, the workers' compensation and safety are funded by a tax on workers. These programs cost about $9 million annually, so that'll remain flat. But as you can see, the tax income has gone down, and that's a good thing. That means that there's less accidents, less appeals being filed. So overall, that is a good thing. However, we still have to fill that budget gap, and right now we're using general funds to fill that. This would just go an extra step to add in another $482,000 to help fill that gap that's not already coming from general funds. So just wrap up, HB 63 saves $482,000, preserves parties' right to have their cases heard in a timely manner, will reduce appeals to the Supreme Court, and make Alaska workers' compensation system more solvent. So thank you.
Thank you, Rep. Rauscher and Mr. McKee. We have a question from Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the chair. So on the commission currently right now, are any of them like attorneys or paralegals that they would know better than an attorney?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative Rauscher, through the chair. Representative Allard, the chair is a lawyer. However, the two commissioners are not.
Interesting. Can I do a quick
follow-up?
Thank you. So, through the chair, I just want you to reiterate with me one more time. You said that there were like 30 cases and we went down to five and the time span hasn't.
Correct. The caseload has gone down significantly. However, the decisions, the time that it takes to render a decision has stayed roughly the same compared to when it was done through the Superior Courts.
Thank you. Madam Chair, can I just make a quick little comment? So I see that there's a letter in here from Eric Croft. He's an attorney, and he's clearly stating that the commission needs to be moved out. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair,
Representative Rauscher.
Just a remark to the last statement. Eric Kropf usually testifies for us here, but I think he's busy, and he wasn't able to testify for us today. So thank you for bringing that.
Of course. Thank you.
Representative Groh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for the sponsor, for the staff. What is the perceived reason why the number of cases has fallen so much over the years?
I think, like we saw in the reduction, for the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Groh, as we've seen, the number of cases overall has dropped. Companies are getting better, more safety. Things have been implemented, so there's not as much of there's not as many cases being filed. There's not as many grievances, and so that is one of the reasons why the number has gone down.
Madam Chair, Representative Rauscher, to Representative Groh, as a business owner, we all look at ways where we don't want someone to get hurt because our compensation it costs money. It does. You know, if you are up on a roof, you're paying way over 45 or 41 or 45 cents on a dollar just for the insurance for this person in case they should get hurt. So, and it goes up. Should somebody get hurt, then you'll pay more and you're required to pay more each time. So businesses are constantly having safety meetings. They're constantly using methods like tying people off on the roof or tying them up on scaffolding when they're doing projects. So that's why safety has gone down and you have less cases coming forward because less people are getting hurt, and that is a good thing.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Any other questions from committee members? Representative Groh.
Thank you. Through the chair, so if I heard correctly, is it that it's a zero fiscal note up to 30 cases?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Groh, correct. They submitted that they can take up to 30 cases, what they've put in here, at no additional costs, and that they can those would be taken up through multiple judges.
Follow up.
And it's just curious, and what happens if there's 31?
For the record, Ryan McKee, staff to Representative George Rauscher, through the chair, Representative Groh, we would need to talk to the courts, and then there is a representative here if you'd like to bring her up and ask, because they would be determining then what the fiscal cost would be over 30. However, if you look at in the history, at least, it's been a good while since that has actually happened.
Does that satisfy your question, Representative Groh?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Seeing no further questions from committee members, we are going to set House Bill 63 aside. Thank you, Representative Rauscher, for your double-decker presentation today.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
That concludes our business for today. I would like to note that I've set a committee, an amendment deadline, for both House Bill 88 and House Bill 63, both by Representative Rauscher, for tomorrow, January 30th, to my office by 5 p.m. The committee will meet again on Wednesday, January 31st at 1 p.m. to bring back and have public testimony on House Bill 88, workhouse work quotas, House Bill 63, repeal Workers' Comp Appeals Commission, both by Representative Rauscher. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect. It is 2:18 p.m.